I'm Dick Hobbs, and I was a professor of sociology and criminology. I worked at various universities. I worked at the University of Durham for the longest, up in the northeast. I was there for 15, 16 years. I was a professor at the LSE, and then I worked briefly for a few years, 3 or 4 years, at University of Essex as a professor of sociology. But my specialism has been criminal life generally, working class culture and criminal life, I guess. That's about it.
The first question to ask, Dick, is we don't often hear professors with accents like yours. How did you get into doing this?
A real slick answer would be that I acquired it at elocution lessons because I wanted to get on in criminology, but that's not, that wouldn't be true. I came into academic life quite late. I left school with two O-levels and two low-grade O-levels, and I just went to work, and I just wanted money to go out the weekend, buy clothes and have a good time and all the rest of it, as most of my friends did. And I started going to night school when I was in my 20s, early 20s. And after quite a few years, I managed to get another O-level and a grade E A-level, which gave me access to teacher training college. Because in those days, you know, it's worth saying that only between 5 and 10% of the population actually went to university. It was quite unusual. So I wasn't aiming for university. I was aiming to be a school teacher, which I thought would be, you know, the absolute pinnacle of my abilities. And I worked as a school teacher. I trained as a teacher, and I worked for a while as a school teacher. All the time that I was training and going to night school and doing teacher training, etc., I was working in warehouses. I was working for the council as a road sweeper and a dustman, and building sites. I worked on for a little while, and eventually I qualified as a school teacher. Worked as a school teacher for 4 years, I think it was. Couldn't really see myself lasting till, you know, the next 30 years or so in that kind of job. And I always wondered what university was like, because teacher training college had been like it was like a certificate in face painting. It was really low rent, you know, astonishingly low rent. So I decided to try to get into university and use my teacher training qualification to get into university. And I managed to get into the London School of Economics. And as soon as I arrived there, absolutely terrified, totally intimidated by the place, things took off for me. I found that I liked doing academic work. I liked sociology. I liked sociology of deviance and crime in particular. And it kind of took off from there. So I guess, you know, that's a long way, a long answer to your question. But I guess what I'm saying is that by the time I got into academia, I was pretty well formed as a human being, and my accent was there and it wasn't going anywhere. And it lasted me through working at the University of Oxford, Durham, LSE, et cetera, et cetera. It's just.
No, no, no. It shouldn't really matter, actually, should it? But I just couldn't help but asking the question. I know you've just come out with a book. Can you tell us about the book? Because I know you've over the years, you know, got quite an insight into the criminal mind.
Yeah, I worked on crime. Initially, I worked on crime in the East End. I did a PhD called Doing the Business, and I turned it into a book, and it won a prize, and it was really looking at just what people did in the East End, ducking and diving, wheeling and dealing, a bit of stealing, dealing in stolen goods, that kind of thing. And I looked at the relationship between those people, that entrepreneurial culture, and the entrepreneurial culture in the old CID. And this was in the 80s, and there was quite a bit of the old ducking and diving life on Mars CID was still around then. And then it took off for me from then. And I moved on. I ended up looking at professional crime, organized crime. And that was it. By the time I was coming to what I decided was going to be the end of my career, because by the time, you know, now we're at not 5 or 10% going to university. I think we're heading towards nearly 50% of the population going. It's turned into a bit of an industry. Their universities feel like factories to me now, as opposed to when I first started off. And I retired just a few years ago, and I thought, well, what do I want to do? And I remember one particular seminar about 10 years ago, it would be, when a student said, she read out a piece of work, and it was the most appalling gobbledygook, the real worst of academic language. It was disgusting. And I said, well, that's absolutely terrible. You know, you've read that out from a book. And it's terrible. No wonder you don't understand it. You know, it's gobbledygook. It's typical of this sort of elitism of British academia and everything. Who on earth wrote that? What idiot wrote that? She said, you did. And the language that I'd use, I started to realise, actually, I've over the years, I've fallen into the trap. I've started to use an obscurest language that only makes sense. It's almost a technical language that only makes sense within the academic sector. And I decided that...
Dick, can I just interrupt for a second? Because we've got the same going on in politics now. A lot of politicians, particularly our Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees, they use this kind of management jargon. And you can see even the journalists. But of course, when he's doing big speeches to rooms full of people, everyone's sort of glazing over and even hearing a snore from the back, you know. So that's the kind of language you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's an interchangeable language that is interchangeable between various institutions. You know, that's it. Particularly if you're talking about crime, you can go down two routes. It seemed to me, and you can go down the kind of academic jargon, language of theory, etc., which is fine. I think you need to be able to do that. Or if you're going down the policy route. You do then start talking like a chief constable, a chief probation officer, or a governor of a prison, and it's interchangeable when it comes to policy. And really, both of those options within academia, that I've done both, I must admit, I've done both of those. They don't really fit, and 99.9% of the population, it's just not going to stick with them. But it's going to do you a lot of good within your particular sphere.
Okay, so tell us about the book.
Right, well, the book, it was an effort really to take the material that I collected since the early 80s when I first went to university and to make that accessible to a more general readership. I mean, one of the things was the price of academic books. I remember I was talking to a mate of mine about something that I'd written, and he said, oh, I'm going to get that book. I thought, nah, don't do it. And he did, and he came back. He said, do you know how much it was? They tried to charge me £65. He said, I thought it was £6.50, but it was £65. And so it's, you know, you don't sell many academic books. It doesn't get to a more general public. So this was an effort to actually make it more available in terms of price, in terms of the language that I used. And to take the material that I collected since the early 80s and right until quite recently and to look at changes in crime, to look at the way that Britain has changed, look at the way that politics has changed. I mean, when I started writing in the early 80s, in my bit of the East End, we still had council housing. We still had something I've described as genuine community. That has been swept away since then. The jobs, the unionised jobs, which you know, crime was involved, was part of that world of unionised jobs. They've been swept away. That world, just, you know, 40 years ago, has gone, has disappeared, and it, you know, it's changed beyond belief. And crime has changed along with it. So I've tried to track the ducking and diving of the docks, the wheeling and dealing, the stolen good networks. I've written stories in there about that. I then move on to the changes that took place when that broke down, the rise of what we now call organised crime. But actually, organised crime is a recent invention in the UK. We've only started talking about it in the early 90s. And that came from the political sphere rather than law enforcement. And looking at what we mean by organised crime, what it is, looking at things like armed robbery, the rise of armed robbery, and then the demise of armed robbery, the way that's gone away. The way that we're all involved in trading relationships now, whether we're involved with the straight world or the bent world, so-called bent world, and to really chart this, but to give very vivid examples, interview data, observational data. You know, I've been in this world now for a long time, probably longer, well, definitely longer than most policemen stay into it. So I felt I had something to say and to make it available to a general readership.
In the East End, we had this thing called Cockney rhyming slang, didn't we? Which was largely an attempt to completely have a whole kind of concealed code language people could communicate with that the higher ups wouldn't be able to understand.
That's right. I mean, a lot of that comes from the costermongers in the 18th and 19th century, and a lot of it was backslang. So you take a word and you just say it backwards, basically, like yob is boy, et cetera, there's loads of it. Then you get into the rhyming side of it. And it still exists today to a certain extent, and it's always changing. New terms are coming in. I can't think of any off the top of my head now, but I know I'm mystified on occasions by words that people are throwing in. And there's a bit of Yiddish in there, a bit of Romany, a bit of backslang. And a lot of imagination, really. But yeah, that's right. It was a way of speaking quite openly in front of all kinds of people. But it was a code. It was a secret code.
Yeah. I mean, just taking a step back from the way crime seems. I mean, you know, I was brought up on things like the Sweeney, which definitely had a bit of an East End feel to it, you know. Yeah. And, you know, those guys were, I mean, you know, they, even one of the producers I remember saying, well, we were like gypsies. We were out there on the street filming this stuff, like in the early morning, basically as people were waking up. It wasn't film sets. It was just out there on the streets. And when people saw these cars screaming by and, you know, action going on, they thought it was for real, but actually, you know, because maybe they hadn't noticed the cameras. And it was a very interesting way of doing it, and you know, I can remember being quite captivated by it. But things have changed since then, haven't they, with policing, I think, because I mean, I remember reading David Southwell's book The History of Organized Crime a few years ago, talking about, you know, the famous gangster families, like obviously the Crays, but I think it was Charlie Richardson who came out of jail in the 1980s and walked straight into a job in the city. So, you know, there does seem to be this shift in you know, it's almost as if there are the elites and the bankers and the financiers, the transnational corporations that actually go out and recruit former criminals because they see that expertise is very valuable in the banking world.
Well, Charlie Richardson was an interesting guy. You know, he was, I think, one of the unfortunate issues about it when we talk about organised crime in the UK, the Crays always come up first. And actually, they were useless criminals. They were not very good gangsters. They didn't make a lot of money. They were clumsy, but they were geniuses. Two things that they're genius for, and that was violence and public relations. And that's why we're still talking about them now. I mean, if you're a gangster, you want to keep your head down. You don't want to publicity. But these guys had, Reg Cray had David Bailey, the most popular, most famous society photographer of the day, taking photographs at his wedding. It's bizarre. The whole thing is bizarre. But the Richardsons were different. And Charlie in particular was different. He saw in the 60s the possibility of moving into white collar crime. He wanted to go transnational. He got into Africa, and he got into a lot of legitimate businesses as well. You know, he got into mineral mining in Africa in the early mid 60s. He was a different kind of character. So by the time he came out, the city of London had exploded, and there was plenty of jobs going. There were plenty of jobs going, but there was plenty of opportunities. I mean, I don't think Charlie actually went into a job. I think Charlie just sort of recognized the possibilities. Charlie Richardson was having conversations about the stock market and how to manipulate the stock market. He was having these conversations with serious fraud officers in the mid-1960s.
Well, that's white collar crime, isn't it? And I suppose what I'm trying to say is, haven't we come to an era now where the criminals don't have to rob the banks, they own them?
They do. I don't think they even need to own them. I mean, there are various stories flying around about owning banks, and that's always been the thing. If you really want to be a criminal, own a bank. But they can manipulate the system. I mean, we know that 2008, the United Nations report, the only thing that kept the only thing that kept the banking system going with the collapse in 2008 was dirty money. It was largely drug money, because that has to keep moving. You have to keep drug money moving, otherwise it's going to get captured, it's going to get spotted, it's going to, if you tie it down for too long. So the only fluidity in the marketplace for quite a long time after the 2008 collapse was bent money. And I think that's the bailout.
I mean, I'm sorry to pull you up on that, but it didn't collapse, did it? It was all bailed out. And so, you know, if you were a cynical person, you could say that this was a great big heist, really. So the banks are saying, oh, gosh, you know, everything's about to collapse. So the government says, oh, have a load of public money then, and you can carry on, you know. So if I was a cynical person, I would say, well, that was actually an incredible heist. They managed to take a whole load of public money there. Anyway, what I suppose I'm coming around to saying is that if you are a criminal large institution and you do embrace things like, you know, whatever, drug crime, and then and you're not prosecuted for it, like HSBC were fined, but, you know, nobody actually at the bank, I mean, this is for, you know, being involved in money laundering and drug dealing and, well, not actually doing drugs themselves, but certainly the proceeds of the drug. So if you don't do that stuff, then, you know, the banks and the financial institutions and the other big organisations that do deal with criminals, they are basically, they start to take over. So if you're not doing that, then you're going to go under. So that's, I suppose, what I'm trying to come around to saying.
Yeah, sure.
Isn't, I mean, there, you know, they establishment
need,
crime.
There needs to be collaboration. There's no doubt about that, because of laundering. You need to wash the money, you need to move the money. And the best way to move the money is through so-called legitimate corporations. And that's what happens. There's also at the lower level, but it's still involving many, many millions of pounds every year. There's other ways of laundering the money where you avoid the banks altogether and you get into property. And property is without a doubt the way to go. So the thing with white collar crime is that we tend not to call these people organized criminals unless they're working class. White collar crime tends to be the preserve of the upper classes. We don't categorize. That's what I'm saying. We don't categorize white collar crime as being organized crime unless it's working class gangsters who are involved in it. And I think that's it. Much of this is about imagery. Much of this is about how we see crime, how we regard crime. Most of the villains that I've known over the last 40 years don't regard themselves as criminals. They regard themselves, well, I was a bit dodgy early on, but now I am a legitimate businessman. I'm legitimate. Or if they're not legitimate, they would like to be legitimate. If they knew how to go legitimate, they would do. Some do and some don't. Some get nicked and some don't. It's a game. And in that respect, it's not changed much since the 1960s, because it was a game then and it's a game now. But the involvement in big finance, in large scale finance, is something that we didn't see in the 60s. You know, villains in the 60s stayed in their own manor. They stayed in their own area. They exploited opportunities that were available locally. Nowadays, if you're going to be really at it, then you're going to have contacts abroad. You're going to have to know someone in Amsterdam. You're going to have to know someone in Thailand, your Caribbean, wherever. And you can operate from anywhere. So territory is irrelevant. So the old idea that, you know, people say to me, oh, yeah, I know about organised crime. The Crays out the East End and the Richardsons out South London. Well, yeah, maybe, but not quite. And certainly now that idea of territory is a nonsense. Territory is for kids working street corners, making their name, making their bones. You don't need a territory anymore. You can operate from anywhere. You sit on a beach in the Cayman Islands with a laptop and you can operate there. You don't need to be present at the scene of the crime. And I think that fluidity that we see in business is reflected in crime and vice versa.
Well, and of course, the people who are supposed to be investigating this, the CID, they don't really seem to, hasn't there been a sort of a dilution of the role of investigative policing, you know, sure. The criminal, you know, the detectives? They don't really seem to be doing anywhere near as much as they used to. And, you know, certainly when I was a youngster, there was an active, it's a bit like investigative journalism. It seems to have died a death.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely. When I started off in the 80s and I was sort of working with CID officers, they were still local. I don't mean to say they were born locally, but they worked locally and they knew villains locally. Now, they could be incompetent, they could be competent, they could be bent, they could be straight, but they were local guys. They knew the local boozers. They knew the local villains. They knew what was going on to a certain extent, and that's how they would operate. So local knowledge was everything. That's not the case anymore. Certainly since the early 90s with the invention of the National Criminal Intelligence Service and then the move through SOCO and now National Crime Agency, dealing with villains is a specialism. So you can't just go into a pub and say, you know, where's Harry? He's in the Dog and Duck next door. We'll go in there and have a drink with him. That's gone. That's a specialism. You've got to go on a special course to talk to criminals. It's an absolute specialism. And it's markedly changed. So if I talk to a cop now and I say, well, who's working locally? I don't know. That's a National Crime Agency. Know that we on some special squad. You know, that's I don't know that. I don't know that anymore. Now, there's a reason for that. I mean, one of the reasons was there was an enormous amount of corruption. If you're hanging about with villains all day long, you're going to get an awful lot of opportunities that are going to come your way. And you may or you may not take those opportunities. But in losing that corruption, in doing away with that corruption, you've lost local knowledge and you've lost a lot of the old skills of detective work. And I think we do suffer from that. So, you know, a lot of crime, I mean, crime now isn't investigated. The idea of being an investigator has pretty much gone out the window. You might create a case, but unless it's really serious and therefore there's lots of overtime going, it's unlikely it's going to be investigated. That's the way that policing has gone. It's administrative. It's the way the health service has gone. It's about administration. It's about the way that higher education, my old business, has gone. It was about being an administrator. It's the world that we live in now. But certainly, I absolutely agree with you. A lot of those old skills of detective work have absolutely gone out the window.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that, you know, the white collar criminal is going to get a knock on the door at 3 o'clock in the morning and get arrested and taken in for questioning is, you know, I think that's one of the problems today is that people who are involved in dubious activities of one sort or another. I mean, I know in Bristol, we have the great and the good of the city. It's a company called Hargreaves Lansdown. They're a big stock trading company that take a lot of people's clients' money and trade it on the stock market. They recently had an enormous collapse in the in one of their funds, which was a big scandal. But Rowan Bosworth Davis, who's a former fraud squad officer, he's turned lecturer and writer. He was telling us that Peter Hargreaves, it's Peter Hargreaves and Stephen Lansdown. Peter Hargreaves, when he started that company, or when it was in its early forms, was interviewed three times under caution back in the early 1990s, late 80s, by him, because he had been taking clients' money and using it to speculate on insider deals. Yeah. And now we don't really, his company is now one of the biggest in the country. You know, he's done rather well on that alleged, I must use that word, alleged offence that he was being questioned on there. But we do see that some of these big financial institutions, there don't seem to be the checks and the balances. But I mean, you know, this is only one aspect, I suppose, white collar crime and that sort of thing. But if you can give us maybe another flavour of your book and remind us of the title of it, some the sorts of stories that people get if they get hold of the book.
Yeah, the book's called The Business Talking with Thieves, Gangsters and Dealers. And one of the things that I got interested in is the role of women in crime. You know, it was always the case. I mean, I was brought up around an awful lot of crime. I mean, I knew a fair bit about crime before I got into it, before I started studying. And one of the things that I knew when I was a kid, I used to play football down the street with a mate of mine, and there was a woman who we used to call her Mrs. Popeye. And she stood out the front of her house, and she did look like Popeye. And she always had a soggy roll up hanging from a bottom lip, not too many teeth in her head, and tattoos on her arm. And she looked like Popeye. And she just stand out the front of her house. That's where we were playing football. And there was always vans and trucks and cars pulling up and boxes coming in and out and everything. And it was, I found out later on, you know, who Mrs. Potwai was. And Mrs. Potwai was a major dealer of stolen goods locally. And her specialisms were Yardley's perfume from the factory just down the road at Stratford, Matson's meat pies. Might have been Telford's, but it was certainly meat pies because we could smell them from the back of my house. And shirts from a local shirt factory. And that's what she did. Now, she wasn't making huge sums of money, but the boxes were coming. The boxes were coming. She'd pass them on. They'd move on. And women would take them to work in the factories and they'd sell them to her friends. And people were making money. And, you know, but it was so normalised. You know, I was just a kid with a bunch of other kids playing football because there was a nice wall that we could bang a ball against that in that particular street. And we all saw it and later on realised what was going on. And that was normalised. And then later on, when I started to interview people and get to know them, I found women getting involved in the drugs trade. So there was a role for women in the drugs trade. But what I noted was that with Mrs. Popeye, she didn't need some brute of a geezer with tattoos and a broken nose standing behind her to provide security. But if you were a woman in the drugs trade, and you could be quite successful in the drugs trade, knocking out a steady income, you may probably be the only wage earner and money maker in your family and supporting the entire family. You probably needed access to violence. You probably needed access to a violent male if you were going to carry on. And I thought that was kind of an interesting switch, an interesting move. So that was a change. And it's something that the drugs traders brought is the potential for violence that in the old thieving days, I remember from when I was a kid and a young man, in the old thieving days, violence was quite rare with regard to doing the business, with regard to that kind of acquisitive crime. Violence, you didn't need violence. You didn't need to protect your money. You weren't making that much. You didn't need to protect your money or protect your goods. Things could go wrong sometimes and things could go wrong. You might get a bit of violence, but it was unusual, extremely unusual. Now it's an ever-present possibility. So in that respect, you know, in terms of the way women's role in society has changed since I started looking at crime, women haven't quite got the same access as men.
Apparently there's honour amongst thieves, you know, and I do wonder about this because if you're brought up in the East End as you were, in you know, fairly poor conditions, I don't know, you know, what your immediate circumstances were, but surely there is a, you know, particularly amongst a close knit community, as the East End definitely was, doesn't crime almost become like the normal reaction to a situation where you feel you're being shafted by wider society, by the rich and powerful?
Yeah, it was normal. It was absolutely normalised. It was everywhere. You know, the first thing that anyone would do when they went into a new job or something is, where's the swindle? You know, where's the swindle? What's in them boxes? I wonder what's over there. I wonder what's over here. People were looking at it all the time. But alongside it, you know, that can be a bit of a cliche because I've got to say, alongside it, there were real attempts. We're talking now about the 50s and 60s is when I grew up. And there was that population that brought us up, my parents' culture that brought us up, that they'd suffered the war, they'd suffered the economic depression of the 1930s, they'd been through the war, really suffered. I mean, my dad, for instance, was away for 6 years during the Second World War. My mum was at home in the East End being bombed day and night for quite a big chunk of that period of time. At the end of the war, all they wanted was security. They wanted security. So the idea, you know, what I had banged down my neck was keep your head down, be good, do as you're told. And that was it. And don't get into trouble with the police because the police were scary. I'm not talking about CID now. I'm talking about your ordinary uniformed police officer. Wasn't exactly Dixon and Doc Green. You know, they were big brutish guys who kick your door in and make your life a misery. And they'll destroy your life. That's what I was told. They'll destroy you. Don't get in trouble with the police. So alongside this kind of ducking and diving, crime is normal culture, you also had a fair chunk of the population were trying to keep on the straight and narrow because they knew what was going to go wrong. If it went wrong, it was going to go severely wrong as well. So there was always an edge. There was always a tension there. You know, it wasn't quite the Wild West where everything was open and everything was stealing and good sign. There was also this effort to be respectable, but it wasn't always possible. I'll give you an example. You know, my mum was absolutely straight, no involvement in crime, etc., etc. But I used to remember that I can remember when I was a kid, about 10 o'clock at night, a knock on the door, which is unusual. That means someone's died. You get a knock on the door at 10 o'clock at night. And my mum would go there and it'd be Mickey, because a guy who lived over the road and he was a docker. And I used to hear the conversation. The conversation would go something along the lines of, you know, I've got the cloth. I've got a roll of cloth here, Mary, because my mum was a dressmaker. She worked for mum. Roll of cloth here, Mary. It'll do for you. Oh, it's not nicked, is it? It's not stolen, because I don't want it if it's stolen. Oh, no, it's not stolen. It's from the auctions, like the last lot. Oh, in that case, put it in the front room. And that was it. So she'd gone through the kind of neutral, what I would have called in my academic days, a neutralisation technique. You know, you neutralise. Oh, it's not stolen, is it? No, it's not stolen. And it got put in the front room. And that was it. So she had a nice cheap bargain. Her conscience was clear. And Mickey had a few bob in his pocket to take down the pub. So that's kind of how a lot of it operated. You know, it was normal. It was normalised.
Just remind us of the title of the book, please, again, Dick.
It's called The Business, talking with thieves, gangsters and dealers, and it's published by John Blake.
Dick Hobbs, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.